Today's podcast of The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
Toyota's American Connection.
At Toyota Motor Manufacturing, Kentucky, Kentuckians build vehicles popular the world over. The Kentucky-built Toyota Camry, Avalon, and Camry Solara.
U.S.-made Toyotas are part of the global recall, and thousands of U.S. workers have no choice but to look to Tokyo to see how the Japanese auto giant responds to its worst crisis in history.
Getting to know you, putting it my way, but nicely.
American workers doing it Toyota's way, but nicely. On The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee from Public Radio International and WNYC.
Good morning, everyone. It's Wednesday, February 10th, and The Takeaway is, what, if anything, are those U.S. workers who work for Toyota learning about their managers across the Pacific?
Well, and whether it's a foreign-owned company or not, those are still American jobs that are endangered down there in Kentucky. Let's get right to the top stories we're following this morning. Toyota at the top of the headlines again. More than 7,000 Camrys are being recalled because of a problem with their brakes. On top of that, government safety officials now say they're looking into a number of complaints with the steering on Toyota Corollas. With Toyota's problems seemingly getting worse by the day, Transportation Secretary Ray LaHood tells NBC News,
"We will not sleep until all of these cars are fixed properly and are safe to drive."
And the problems are not just limited to Toyota. Honda has added another 400,000 cars in the U.S. to its global recall for faulty airbags. Japan's number two automaker has been recalling cars since 2008. Today's latest expansion includes certain Accords, Civics, and Acuras.
Back to Toyota, though, there is a U.S. connection here, and it's not just consumers, people who own Toyotas. We're joined now by State Representative Charlie Hoffman from District 62 in Kentucky, which includes that Toyota plant we alluded to at the top of the hour. Representative Hoffman, good morning. Good morning.
Good morning.
So have you gotten to know Toyota management a little better, for better or worse, in these last few weeks with all the recalls?
Yes, I have. I've had quite a bit of correspondence with them. They're letting us have information because they know we're probably going to be talking to a lot of people about the recall, and they seem to really be earnestly trying to keep us up with communications.
Well, we will see how confident that makes you and people of Kentucky feel when we talk a little more about what's going on down there in Kentucky as Toyota workers look to the future for their jobs. Representative Hoffman, stay with us. We'll be back with you in just a moment.
Moving overseas, U.S. and Afghan forces have moved to the edge of the city of Marja, a major supply and drug smuggling stronghold for the Taliban. Earlier in The Takeaway, we asked Captain Abraham Sipe, a spokesman for Camp Leatherneck in the Helmand province, why is NATO publicizing this upcoming offensive?
The added risk that we might be taking by giving a warning is actually going to be outweighed by the benefits of letting the people know that, hey, this is what we're about to do, and we're doing it for the long-term safety and security of your homes.
You can hear that entire interview at our website, thetakeaway.org. Here at home, a severe snowstorm is sweeping into the Northeast this morning, bringing as much as a foot of snow to Washington, D.C., Baltimore, and Philadelphia.
President Obama used an impromptu news conference as an occasion to talk tough about Iran's nuclear program.
We're going to be working on over the next several weeks is developing a significant regime of sanctions that will indicate to them how isolated they are from the international community as a whole.
The sanctions will reportedly be aimed at Iran's Revolutionary Guard. And at the White House last night,
anybody here seen my old friend Martin?
Smokey Robinson, among the people who were welcomed to the White House to celebrate Black History Month. Let's look at the markets now. Asian and European markets are up. Futures are up, too. The Dow gets underway at 10,058. The S&P opens at 1,070, and the NASDAQ opens at 2150. We're asking you this morning, do you have memories of a snow day of your youth? It's all over the East Coast. Snow days, 877-8-MY-TAKE or MyTAKE at thetakeaway.org. Coming up, Toyota in Kentucky.
You're
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee.
Good morning, everyone. We begin with those parallel universes in the U.S. car industry. While Detroit was shrinking over the last 20, 30 years, there's really been a rise in the manufacturing capacity of Japanese-owned factories in places like Kentucky and Tennessee. Have you visited any of those facilities?
I have been to several of them before, yeah.
Nissan plant in Tennessee. There's a Honda plant also, and we were talking about the Toyota plant there in Kentucky. It involves thousands and thousands of workers. These are typically non-union workers, but very much concerned about their jobs and very much concerned about the recalls coming out of Toyota that have certainly attracted the attention of the world and have lit a fire underneath the Toyota management in Japan.
A fire that they have never had to deal with before.
Indeed. Well, you're dealing with it now. State Representative Charlie Hoffman, representative of State House District 62 in Kentucky, the home of Toyota Motor Manufacturing Kentucky, the subsidiary there. Good morning again, Representative.
Good morning.
And also joining us is Marianne Keller, an automotive industry analyst and consultant and author of Collision, GM, Toyota, Volkswagen, and the Race to Own the 21st Century. Good morning, Marianne.
Good morning.
What do you think the issue is for American workers who work for some of these foreign-owned companies, particularly Toyota, with all the headlines and the safety issues and recalls that have been announced over the last few weeks? Marianne?
I think that you have to remember that that the factories in the United States are assembly plants. The cars are designed and engineered in Japan. So American workers are, to some extent, vulnerable to decisions that are made far away from where they actually produce the vehicles. I think that putting it into perspective, first, recalls are very common. Automobiles are very complex machines, and most of us have had one or more recalls on our vehicles, and we just take them back to the dealer and get them fixed. Because we expect that the manufacturer will stand behind the product and make the repair. In the case of Toyota, what went wrong in that process, which is normally virtually invisible, is the fact that the problems persisted over a number of years, and we can see that it goes back in some models, back to 2005 model year product, and they seem to ignore the severity of it, forcing a member of the DOT staff to actually go to Japan to convey the importance of this and the seriousness of it, is without precedent, I think. So I think that they failed really in understanding that they had a severe problem. They allowed the problem to get out of control, and then they frankly have not been able to contain the news around that problem.
Well, let's get a reaction from State Representative Charlie Hoffman. Marianne Keller suggests that there's not a lot of manufacturing done at your plant. You do manufacture engines, I believe, at your plant in Kentucky. And how much confidence do you have, given that Toyota management has really been sort of caught with their pants down here?
Well, we understand the gravity here, especially locally, with the plant lines closing down for about 7 days and no production. We realize that it is a bad situation. Now the line has started back up. They're producing cars now, and anything that happens at the Toyota plant here in Georgetown is big news here locally, because it is our largest employer. I think about 6,800 workers.
That's huge.
And
how vulnerable do those workers feel? I mean, these are non-union shops. Marianne Keller suggests that you're vulnerable because it's mostly an assembly operation. Do your workers and do your constituents, you're a Democratic representative in District 62, are they telling you that kind of thing?
No, because the Toyota officials assured. And there were no layoffs during the time all the plants, the workers came to the plant and did basically housekeeping functions, I think, during that time, and everyone so no one had to take time off during that time.
And that gives you confidence that at least management in Tokyo is trying to preserve jobs. Marianne Keller, is there precedent for Toyota looking out for workers? Or maybe is there more of a precedent of them doing the math and being a little more draconian in how they preserve jobs?
What Toyota has done in being able to keep the UAW out of its factories, frankly, is make two promises. First, that their compensation is effectively at a UAW rate. So if you're being paid essentially close to something that a UAW worker at GM makes, there's really not a financial incentive to join a union. And the second thing that Toyota has made good on, a promise of continuous employment. And so Toyota uses quite a few temporary workers who will sort of fill in the gaps when production lines are moving at breakneck speed and might be expendable when they're not. But the core of their workforce, the permanent workforce, has always had this promise of job security through thick and thin. And it's very traditional, very typical for them to come in and do training and housekeeping and other sort of non-assembly type jobs during periods like this. You know, during model changeover, for example, there may be a week or so when the plant will not be running at full tilt. So this is characteristic, and this is how, frankly, they have been able to keep the UAW out of their factories. They're not the only ones. It's very common in most of the factories that don't have union representation.
Certainly Detroit has seen a radical shift in the economic realities of the auto business domestically. Are we likely to see a similar shift beginning with these recalls? Maybe it's not causal, but beginning with these recalls in the foreign-owned automakers in the United States?
I don't think that, we should be looking at Toyota and seeing that Toyota is about to go through, a multi-year slide the way GM did. I think that this has been a wake-up call for the management. They are a very, very effective team when it comes to engineering vehicles.
And we're going to see them in action because they're visiting the United States over the next few weeks. Some hopeful words there for workers in Kentucky. State Representative Charlie Hoffman and Marianne Keller, automotive industry analyst, talking about Toyota and the jobs that it has in the United States. Thanks so much. And at 15 minutes after the hour, let's check in on some of the other stories we're following.
The government in Haiti says it now believes 230,000 people were killed in last month's earthquake. That's close to the number of people killed in the Asian tsunami 5 years ago. Meanwhile, the 10 American missionaries detained on child kidnapping charges in Haiti say the U.S. government could be doing more to help them. The group's Haitian lawyer says even the children's parents are opposing the kidnapping charges.
Parents of the kids testify under the judge that they gave the agreement to the orphanage to give the children to the American missionaries.
UNICEF says attempts are still being made to smuggle children out of Haiti to combat the problem. Specially trained officials are checking documents at the airport and the country's border. Back at home, it's snowing along the East Coast. Thousands of workers are scrambling to plow and salt roads as the blizzard descends upon states from Virginia to Connecticut.
Abroad, tens of thousands of public sector workers in Greece have taken to the streets. They're protesting the government's plans for tackling the nation's huge deficit. But most markets rose amid expectations the European Union will have a financial rescue for Greece. Astronauts for the Space Shuttle Endeavour say they're impressed with what they're seeing from the International Space Station. The crew received a warm welcome when they arrived and docked today. And as Ed Sullivan might have said long ago on our show, The Beatles. That's actual beetle noise coming up. There's a way to keep the pests in check, and it involves that sound.
That's not the Beatles I was thinking of.
In a few minutes, yeah, it's a little different.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Hey, you want that to go?
Time now for some takeouts on stories you're following this week. And, of course, Congress is closed today and probably for a few more days this week because of the blizzard heading all up and down the East Coast. But Todd Zwillick, Takeaway Washington correspondent, it's not just that's the, not the only thing slowed down this week. The president seems to be upset that the process of confirming nominees has been slowed as well.
If the Senate does not act to confirm these nominees, I will consider making several recess appointments during the upcoming recess, because we can't afford to allow politics to stand in the way of a well-functioning government.
Todd Zwillick, what is a recess appointment?
Well, of course, as you know, Celeste, the Constitution gives the Senate the power of advice and consent. The president makes an appointment for someone in the administration. The Senate confirms them. But it also says if Congress is gone for whatever reason, the president can appoint someone during a recess. And that means the Senate is sort of out of the picture. These are very controversial. It drives senators nuts when presidents do this. You remember possibly that Democrats carped a lot when President Bush made recess appointments. In fact, John Bolton, former UN ambassador, he's been a guest on the show many times. He was recess appointed, and it drove Democrats crazy. Now the Democrats are talking about allowing the president to make recess appointments, and now it's driving Republicans crazy. Listen to Senator John Kyle. He's the Republican whip, and he seems to remember, you know, a couple of years ago when the tables were turned. Listen to this.
Democrats squealed when President Bush tried to do it as if it were something immoral and evil, and I would just ask people to be consistent in their view toward recess appointments. That was then, this is now.
Well, we'll see. Certainly nothing's going to get done this week because of the snow, or not much anyway. Todd Zwillick, our Takeaway Washington correspondent.
Our next takeout comes from São Paulo, Brazil. Paulo Cabral, BBC reporter in Brazil, joins us. So consider the fate of a populous nation with an epidemic of AIDS. What do? You take twice the population of Texas, you know, that number of condoms, and essentially dump it on the population. That's what's going on in the annual Carnival Festival, which begins on Saturday in Rio. Brazilian health officials think 55 million condoms can do the trick, Paulo?
Yes, well, actually, this campaign has been going on for the last 10 years. Every carnival, they distribute condoms and make these conscientization campaigns. Actually, the AIDS epidemic is pretty much under control in Brazil. It's actually getting out of hand again because since treatments have gotten better, what health officials understand is that people don't see AIDS anymore as such a bad thing as it was in the 80s and 90s when medicine was not so much available or efficient. So, yeah, they have launched now a campaign 1 week before Carnival incentivating people to use condoms, and there will be another week of campaign after Carnival to incentivize people to test themselves if they did not use condoms during Carnival.
In the last 10 years of this program, has the Catholic Church changed its views on liberally distributing birth control like condoms?
Well, the Catholic Church often is against the distribution of condoms for contraceptive reasons. They do not say that much during Carnival. It's a huge festival. It's sort of a countrywide spring break with grown-ups taking part. So pretty much you don't see many people going against the distribution of condoms here.
Or going to church, for that matter. Paulo Cabral, BBC reporter in São Paulo, Brazil. Thanks so much.
And now let's talk about Beatlemania. That's Beetle. Bark beetles, the insects. They've been eating away at trees and leaving them dead. It's a terrible epidemic, and it's actually causing wildfires as well in the West. We're joined now by Richard Hofstetter, a forest entomologist at Northern Arizona University. And I believe, Richard, you guys think you've discovered a solution to the bark beetle that's been plaguing the West for years.
Yes, we have been looking at some alternatives, and we are looking at how bark beetles communicate acoustically, and that has led to some very interesting results where we've been able to affect their behaviors and maybe protect trees.
Well, you discovered that beetles were irritated by loud noises, and you tried playing loud rock music. You even tried playing Rush Limbaugh.
There's nothing to stop any of this. Nothing stopping it.
But even that didn't scare these insects. What worked?
Yeah, what seemed to work is we manipulated sounds that were relevant to them. So we often targeted calls and sounds that they would make and play them back, and it seemed to influence behaviors. And so we were able to alter their interest in going into trees, cause a stressful environment, even sometimes kill each other.
So here's an example of a sound you're playing. This is the sound of the beetles' bodily functions when they're eating at trees.
Oh, that's disgusting.
Really? It kind of sounds like
horrible.
A techno music underbeat.
I want to kill myself.
So, Richard, Richard Hofstetter, why does this disturb the Beatles?
Yeah, you know, that's the sound of aggressive male, and, you know, when another male hears that sound, he responds in a very significant way, and so he usually will start to attack its neighbors. So, for instance, this male would attack a female that it's tunneling with, and results in mortality.
Yeah. You're starting a bar fight.
That's essentially, yeah, exactly.
You're aggravating the males so that they start hitting each other.
Yeah. And in this case, it's often the female that's next to it. Yeah.
I love this. So, Richard Hofstetter, you've provided an insight as to why Rush Limbaugh doesn't affect me when I hear him, because he's not relevant, right?
Oh. That's true. And we found that the music and human voice didn't really affect them. After a while, they got used to the sound.
Is this effective? Can this actually wipe out all these Beatles that have been terrorizing the West?
Well, I don't know if it's going to wipe them out, but maybe it can be used for individual tree protection, maybe high-value trees. It's really a device that we're looking at for individual trees.
Okay. Richard Hofstetter is an entomologist from Northern Arizona University's Forest Program. He joined us from Flagstaff, Arizona. Coming up, since the economic downturn, many Americans have had to tighten their belts. One of the things they're cutting back on? Child support payments. We're going to talk about the economy's effect on child support payments and what we can do about it in just a few minutes.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee.
Coming up, the United States already had a problem with payments of child support. At least the courts are already having problems with that. Guess what happened after the recession? It's gotten worse. We're going to talk about that more in a few moments. First, here's some of the news stories we're following at 30 minutes after the hour. Add 7,000 Camrys to the growing list of Toyota's recalls. There are problems with the brakes in some 2010 models. On top of that, government safety officials now say they're looking into a number of complaints with the steering on Toyota Corollas. Earlier this hour, we spoke to State Representative Charlie Hoffman from District 62 in Kentucky. That includes a Toyota plant that employs nearly 7,000 workers. He told us there haven't been any layoffs, but there is serious concern.
Anything that happens at the Toyota plant here in Georgetown is big news here locally, because it is our largest employer.
If you own one of the recalled Toyota Prius cars, the company says you'll start getting letters with information next week.
In Haiti, the government has raised the death toll for last month's earthquake to 230,000 now, making the disaster as deadly as the 2004 Asian tsunami. And officials say that number, 230,000, doesn't include bodies buried in private ceremonies. Further confirmation now this morning that Pakistan's Taliban leader is dead. This morning, Pakistan's top civilian security official offered the government's first official confirmation of the killing of the militant last month in a U.S. drone strike. Here at home, they're revising the so-called Bible of Psychiatry. The American Psychiatric Association is relabeling various disorders in its diagnostic manual. Some suggestions from experts so far include children who throw too many tantrums could be diagnosed with temper dysregulation with dysphoria. Men who are just way too interested in sex face being labeled as suffering from hypersexual disorder. And the experts also want binge eating and gambling to be registered as official mental disorders. Let's check the markets with our short attention span. Asian and European markets are up now. Futures are up, too, because of concerns about Greek debt actually getting solved. That's a positive force on the market. The Dow gets underway at 10,058. The S&P opens at 1,070, and the NASDAQ begins at 2150 when Wall Street starts trading later on this morning. Those are some of the stories we're following.
There's a lot of issues associated with a recession. We've talked on this program a lot about the difficulty in paying mortgages, the problems with finding a job. Today, we want to talk about the Americans who've been unable to pay child support. In Tennessee alone, child support payments are down $13 million from last year. We're joined by a woman who has to deal with this in her daily life. Sheila Jones Calloway is a magistrate in Tennessee, and she hears about many cases dealing with child support. We're also joined by Carlos Jarrett, a father of three in Tennessee, and he's had difficulty paying child support for one of his kids lately. Good morning to both of you.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Magistrate Calloway, are you seeing an increase in cases dealing with child support in your courtroom?
We're definitely seeing an increase in cases, yes.
And what are are most of them coming from laid off parents?
They are coming from laid off parents. We're also getting a lot of cases where the state has generated petitions on behalf of the mother, or usually the mother, nine times out of ten of the mother, because she's having to receive state assistance. whenever a woman receives any type of state assistance, they have to assess child support. And so we're seeing an increase in those types of cases.
Carlos, you pay child support for your three-year-old daughter.
Yes.
And you're having trouble doing that lately. Why is that?
Just due to my income level staying the same, and all of my other expenses are increasing. Just everyday living expenses in addition to trying to maintain two other children.
So you have two children that live with you?
Yes.
And you pay child support for the third. You have not lost your job,
No.
but your other expenses have increased while your income has not gone up. Is that what's happened?
Correct.
You know, I have to, in the interest of full disclosure, I myself am a single mother who receives child support. That's a check that very often I've needed a lot. So, Carlos, I mean, for those who are on the other side, this is an issue for both sides. This is not just an issue for you, but for the caretaker of your child as well.
Right. But at the end of the day, I think we all have to understand that we're all in this thing together. And on some levels, we have to be able to bend a little. I would think... it would be a good thing if we could, you know, maybe reduce it a little and have it where we may be able to just kind of pay, you know, so much extra, because you know as well as I know that even with the amount that you receive, there are other things that may come up that you may have to call your child's father, you know, for extra.
Go ahead.
So in my situation, when that happens, that becomes an extra burden. And I don't like for mine to go without, you know, for, you know, all, you know, everybody involved.
So, Magistrate Calloway, you must hear these kinds of cases all the time. How do you try to balance the interests of these two parents, both of whom may be struggling, but there's a child in there that still has to have clothing and food and proper care?
It's very difficult to balance on many levels, as Mr. Jarrett has said and as you have said as well. The bottom line is we've got to do what's best for the children. And I've told many fathers over and over again, if you have to do without, if, you know, as a mother, you may have to do without some things, but the child has to be taken care of. And if the child needs school supplies, the child needs food, clothing, the child might need extras so that all of our children can achieve more than what we have, then we have to do without as a parent sometimes.
It seems like it would be complicated, though, because as you heard from Carlos, he has two kids he's taking care of at home, and he's saying that in order for him to meet the demands of the one kid who has court-ordered support, his two children that he's taking care of are sacrificing.
And sometimes that happens, and it is difficult. It's very difficult for the court. We have to follow the law and follow the guidelines that we're given in order to set support. And we are able at sometimes to deviate from the guidelines if we find good reason to do so. But a lot of times we just have to tell the parents that they're just going to have to either get a second job or just do a little more in order to take care of the kids.
So in your state, Magistrate, the state's collected $13 million less in child support than they collected last year?
I believe that's the correct numbers, yes.
Is the state having to step in some cases where parents just can't make up the difference?
In most of the cases that we receive the collections for, it is a state. The state is stepping in to get the collections. And once again, it says if they're receiving any type of state assistance, whether it's they're receiving insurance for the kids through the state or receiving any type of food stamps or any type of state assistance, then, yes, the state is going to step in to try and get the support payments.
Carlos, you heard the magistrate talking about making sacrifices when the kids need it. Your plea to have your support payments lowered was denied. Are you able to take a second job?
Well, anytime you do that, they add more support onto to it because of your income, period. So anything extra that I do, I try to do with what I have. And as far as having a second job, that's just one of those things. You know, when you have two other kids to take care of, you can't get a second job because of the amount that it time that they require.
Okay.
So with that being said, second job is not something that I can do.
Okay. Carlos Jarrett, father of three in Tennessee. Sheila Jones Calloway is a magistrate in Tennessee as well, both of them out of Nashville. Coming up, with the new renewed fight against obesity, I should say, one way to get people eating healthier is by moving it closer to you. We're going to talk about a group that's raising fish and produce there. They're in an industrial warehouse in the heart of Milwaukee. They get the food closer to them, and that helps them eat healthier. We're going to talk about that later this hour.
We're joined on a line with a little bit of delay from Islamabad, Pakistan. Jane Perlez, the New York Times correspondent in Pakistan, joins us with an interesting story this morning in the Times, which could represent Pakistan's effort to get back involved in the conflict in Afghanistan, or an attempt to really assist the United States in that conflict. Jane Perlez, has Pakistan and the military actually offered to mediate between NATO and the Taliban?
Well, I think it's early days right now, but I do think that the Pakistan military sees that the United States is not going to be in Afghanistan forever, and that talks are going to have to solve the situation in the end after fighting and talking and fighting and talking. To say that it's a formal offer is probably a little too bold, but they've certainly told the Americans that they want to be helpful or they want to be involved in bringing some of the irreconcilables along, and that would mean the Haqqanis who sit in North Waziristan.
And, you know, you describe a meeting attributed to a senior administration official that was a pretty high-level meeting.
I'm sorry, you've dropped.
Yeah, the meeting that you describe in your article.
I cannot hear you.
All right, Jane Perlez, who
I am very sorry, I'm
really can't hear us there from Islamabad, Pakistan, but you can go to our website where we link to the story that Jane Perlez has. It really involves the Pakistan in the middle of this offensive that's just beginning today, Celeste, in Helmand Province, a meeting last month between Stanley McChrystal, Mike Mullen, other NATO officials, and a Pakistani general who offered that possibly the Pakistan military could be a mediator with the Taliban. It's unclear how the U.S. would actually receive such an offer.
How effective Pakistan would be, but the news that they're willing to take that role is encouraging, and because, you know, Pakistan has not always been eager to step in these particular conflicts.
And we should remind people, Jane Perlez, who has long experience as a correspondent in South Asia and particularly Pakistan, most recently cautioned this is not a formal offer, and it is, again, unclear whether this complicates the situation or actually assists the situation, but there is a long-standing relationship between the Pakistani military and U.S. forces. Our final takeout is the listener response to a story that we did earlier this week. Sierra Jones, her story was part of our series The Value with correspondent Farai Chidea. We looked at people's values in the face of tough economic and personal times.
I was actually in my first year of college in Tallahassee, Florida, on a scholarship, model student, and I ended up pregnant. So I decided to come back home and stay with my mom and try to do school here. It was never really a good situation at my mom's home ever since I was younger. So eventually it led to them giving me a day to find somewhere to live.
Well, Ciara Jones' story, and you can see more of it on our website, thetakeaway.org, really caused a conversation to begin on our website.
That's right. Robert posted, "This story is awful. Yet another single mother, yet another child brought into the world under the worst possible circumstances. No mention of the child's father, no mention about the child. The subject of this story is not a hero. She is yet another woman who's advanced the decline of the American family in general and the black family in specific."
You're listening to The Takeaway from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning. I'm Celeste Headley here with John Hockenberry. Can you get farm fresh produce if you live in the heart of Manhattan or Los Angeles? We're going to talk to one person who's growing produce and farming, fishing for fish in a downtown Milwaukee warehouse. More on that in a few moments. First, let's check on leading stories at 47 minutes after the hour. Honda takes center stage in automotive news today. A recall over airbags that started more than a year ago has ballooned to nearly a million Hondas worldwide. Sticking with safety, the FAA is close to wrapping up a two-year investigation of violations at American Airlines. The result could be one of the largest fines in the agency's history, expected to be around $10 million. Officials say the investigation involves problematic wiring flooring that could be a fire hazard. And former Illinois Governor Rod Blagojevich heads to court today to answer revised charges that he tried to sell President Obama's old Senate seat. His defense attorney says the arraignment should be routine with a simple not guilty plea.
Powerful storms brought heavy snow to the Midwest and is now coating parts of the East. Bob Orovec is the lead forecaster at the National Weather Service. He has some details.
The current storm system will abate later in the day on Wednesday for the Washington, D.C. area and be done by Thursday in the New York City area. And after that, we have a fairly tranquil weekend, but there is some signs of another storm potential earlier in the week or early next week along the East Coast.
This storm has grounded hundreds of flights from New Jersey to Washington. In New York City, the public schools are closed for only the third time in the past 6 years. In Afghanistan, on the eve of what appears to be a major NATO assault into Helmand Province, more than 150 people have been killed in avalanches that blocked the mountain pass north of Kabul. More than 2,000 people have been rescued so far. Those are some of the stories that we're following this morning.
First Lady Michelle Obama is fired up.
We have to act. So let's move. Let's get this done. Let's move to get families and communities together to make healthy decisions for their kids.
That is her kicking off her campaign called Let's Move. It's a White House initiative to fight childhood obesity. Will Allen was actually at the press conference with the First Lady yesterday. He's been working with local communities to help them gain access to healthy food. He's the CEO of Growing Power, a nonprofit urban farming outfit that teaches city dwellers how to grow food. Good morning, Will.
Good morning.
One thing that First Lady Michelle Obama talked about yesterday is food deserts, and we've been hearing about a lot about this lately. What is a food desert?
Well, my definition is a area where there's no real access to good food, where there are no grocery stores, where you have a very dense population, a way up to travel, 3-4 miles before you get to a retail grocery store, with many people in low-income communities not having cars, transportation. It's kind of not very practical to get on a bus and go pick up significant amounts of food, especially for those families that have children.
And there's a lot of urban areas that are like this. I lived in Detroit for a long time. Many places in Detroit are a so-called food desert where people had have to travel a long way to get any kind of fresh food. How do you solve that? You certainly can't. It's a difficult thing to bring the people to the food or solve the public transportation part of it.
Right. Well, one of the ways, of course, is one of the things that we found in our work is that in every community there is a daycare center, a school, or a social service agency, and those places could become food centers where food could be dropped via CSA-type box that we do called Market Basket, where we drop a bag of food, about 14 different fruits and vegetable items each week. It's enough to feed a family of four for a week with those items. And that's been a very effective way to get food into those communities, to really partner with those agencies.
So one of the things that you have done on your own is you've started this company called Growing Power. It's a nonprofit urban farming initiative. And what you do is really kind of amazing to me. You actually take old warehouses and industrial spaces, and you use something called aquaponic agriculture to turn them into farms.
Well, I bought the last remaining farm in the city of Milwaukee in 1993, and over the years it's grown to a national, international training center for urban agriculture and small-scale farming. So folks come from all over the country now to get trained in how to grow more intensively, because the fact is that we've lost a lot of our ag land, and a lot of our ag land is occupied by growing commodities such as soybeans and corn to produce mostly sugars.
Right.
So what we're doing is getting folks in the city to grow food, take control and responsibility of growing their own food, because urban agriculture isn't something new. People have been growing food for years in their backyards and side yards, very silently, but because of the dense population and the fact that more people are moving into cities worldwide, it's going to be necessary. It's not a choice. We just have to, if we want to eat good food, we're going to have to grow some of it ourselves and have farmers markets, farm stands,
Let's explore that a little bit. Will Allen, of course, CEO of Growing Power, which is a nonprofit urban farming initiative. You know, this is way more, considerably more than just some, if you'll, you know, forgive me, smushy, just social program for neighborhoods, urban neighborhoods. This is a serious business model. There's a community garden right down from where I live in Brooklyn that's next to one of the biggest projects in in Brooklyn and in the United States, really. And they grow tons of fresh produce, and some of it goes to the neighborhood, but they also sell high-value produce to the restaurant trade in the city. You can actually make money doing this. Isn't that true?
Oh, yeah. I mean, we have 40 employees, a budget of about $3 million now. And we have a very diversified marketing scheme to get food to everybody, not only folks in those communities, but to be able to fund ourselves and create jobs. We're marketing to corporate cafeterias, to school systems, the Milwaukee public school system. We deliver food right from the same city, right into the school system,
but
restaurants.
Will, are there environmental issues if you're doing aquaculture? I mean, that can be some pretty smelly stuff if you're talking about ponds with fish like catfish and carp.
Well, no, it really, really isn't. These systems are natural systems, recirculating systems that cost a fraction of what commercial systems cost. For every gallon of water, you can grow a fish. So these systems are inside greenhouses and inside buildings in Milwaukee, and we're raising thousands of fish. And these systems can be easily replicated. Folks are coming from all over the world to learn how to build these really pretty simple systems that require one pump to move the water, and gravity and water pressure moves the water through plants. So it's called aquaponics, and it's a symbiotic relationship between the plants and the fish. So you get two crops. You get vegetables, and you also get fish.
You know, that Michelle Obama talked about her wake-up moment when she realized that she needed to take on this issue, and I can't help but think of your journey here. You were a professional basketball player in Europe, and then you became a district sales manager for Kentucky Fried Chicken, and I looked up Kentucky Fried Chicken, like a basic meal there. We're talking about meals that are about 1,000 calories or so a piece. It's not extraordinarily healthy food. And now you've come into this to do urban agriculture and growing watercress and fresh fish. How did you get here?
Well, I actually grew up on a farm right outside of Washington, D.C., on the border of Bethesda and Rockville. So I come from a farm background, went to college, played professional basketball, and wound up in Europe, where I got reacquainted with farming, because the Europeans actually grow healthy food the way we did when I was growing up. So that was my wake-up call, that something was missing in my life. And once I got back here, of course, I had going into farming is a very expensive thing, and I, to make a long story short, I took some corporate jobs, which for a time, and until I was able to purchase a farm. I farm 100 acres of my own farm, and then I bought this farm in the city.
And now you're growing food for lots and lots of people and telling people other people how to do it, too. Will Allen is the CEO of Growing Power. It's a nonprofit urban farming initiative. Thanks so much.
Thank you very much.
Sort of the real agricultural end of the Let's Move program. So go to our website. You can see more about that urban farm. And as always, you can nominate who had a good week and who had a bad week with our friend at the Week magazine.
My name is Daniel, calling from Beaufort, South Carolina. My nominee for who's having a good week is Jenny Sanford, who's been on pretty much every television show and in every newspaper for the past week. For who's having a bad week, I would say her husband, who's alone in the governor's mansion.
That's your nomination. You can join us at 877-8MYTAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org and tune in on Friday to the Week segment from The Week magazine. Good week, bad week. I'm John Hockenberry.
And I'm Celeste Headlee. This is The Takeaway.
Thanks for listening to the Takeaway Podcast. If there's a story you think we should look at or a conversation you'd like us to start, drop us a line at 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org.
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.